Alright, so let me just start by going through some of the web resources, just in case you were not, because I have changed them a little. So, most of the web resources for this project live in two places. I guess the basic one you hopefully have seen is this summary of course materials, which ingeniously has a background guaranteed to make certain you can't read it. So I don't have time to change the background. So you will find sundry, so you'll find in here, I put basically a description of what we did each time. So like it says, so it says on November 8th, we started our study of partial differential equations, covering the basic overview of the types of equations, and start on iteration methods. And then it gives you here a link, and if you happen to press on that link, you will get to this page here, which is the full FOIL set, which is handed out to you. So you will have, this FOIL set is one of the ones that should be, you should have. So all these FOIL sets here have if you press some image, you should get that image like that. Now you also will find that you will find as I mentioned in email, I did put the audio that we recorded for several of the last weeks up on the web. So if you go to this one, which I got to by clicking on this link called audio lecture, which is the audio lecture from November 8th. There's also a different audio lecture for November 7th. And I haven't finished yet, I have from October 22nd onwards. I have 8 of them done. So if you click there, you'll get a so-called audio lecture, which looks the same as the previous lectures, except it isn't really. Because if you well, that's interesting. Let's try November 7th. For some reason November 8th isn't working, but if I go back to November 7th, where somehow I must not have copied yet November 8th to the web correctly. So, in general, if you go to an audio lecture, you will find that the FOILs have little buttons called audio, and if you press on those buttons, you're meant to get something more interesting than that. Alright, so last time, which was back.
So you'll get the audio of that lecture.
History or something.
So you'll notice.
Ending in MPI. you will notice that almost all foils begin with the word so, and two or three arms, and so on. So you can, these are all done with real audio, and so you will need to install the real audio player is available for almost all machines, and this will actually run over a 28.8 kilobaud modem, if you happen to have a 28. So this real audio is designed to run over slow speed lines. And if you press the help button, it will actually tell you the difference between these two buttons here. Audio server streams the audio from the server. Audio downloads the audio file and plays it on your local machine, and it tells you how long it is, 70.5 seconds, and you can, on this machine here, the audio downloads reasonably quickly, and you'll get the same information. But so the advantage of this, if you have a flaky line or link or something like that, you can download it, then it's purely on your client. So with glitches, like I just found that one on November 8th, which I will correct, this is meant to, if you compare the audio lecture, you will find it has a set of foils. It usually is true that the first two foils have no audio because they're title and abstract, which I add later on. I will add some, maybe I'll add audio later on. The audio is only on foils 3 onwards, but you will find these foils are the same foils as in these complete foil sets, but just the ones I talked about, because on any given day I don't do a complete foil set, I just do part of a foil set. So, for instance, this blocking receive, MPI underbar receive, is probably around foil 21 in the MPI presentation. If you click there, you will get the full MPI presentation. And the full MPI presentation, so I mean, here's the MPI receive. Yeah, so it's actually foil 22. So you have then on the web the sort of logical foil sets, which are what you get handed out as printouts, and then you get what I did, which is a selection of foil sets. So on the on November 7th, I happened to do the end of MPI, and then I went to this foil set on Jacobi iteration, and I did 6 foils out of a set of around 45, where I'd done the earlier foils many weeks ago. So this is meant to be and that has to be true, because these foils are meant to be linked to audio, so I can only put the foils up here which I actually talked about. So you should find on the web then the sequential treatment and the treatment as given to you, where the treatment as given to you will only be there if there was audio. So some feedback I'd like at some later stage, and it would have to fold in the inconvenience of not having this technology working, is whether the audio has value to you. it actually has some quite interesting value to me, because I find out what I say, which is often not the same as what I write. So maybe it will help the students next year, because I can use this audio to improve my presentation. Alright. There's another... Let me go to... There are various... I go to if I go to this one, so I guess what I'm well, actually let me give you something else. So if you you go to this particular URL, which is the MPAC server's user GCF summary 0.html, you will find a list of all foil sets, and you will find the foil sets for this class down in here, where it's because they're done alphabetically, and they all start with CPS 615, and you may find that an easier way to find foil sets you want. I guess a capability which may or may not be useful is if you there's a search capability on most of these pages, and if you type words into that search, here I've typed quantum into the search, it will give you back all pages which have that word on it. So you will find the searching is available at various levels of granularity. And if I go to this one here, which is probably the one I'm going to talk about today, it will say basic foil set search. And you can search this particular foil set, which I think actually has quantum in it. And with a bit of so didn't have it. But that, so in principle, you should be able to search the full set of foil sets and each individual foil set. That is not fully implemented yet, because I only added that capability. Another, you can also access this information with this particular URL, which is byarea0.html, and then you'll have a whole bunch of categories of foils. So for instance, this is the course we're doing here now, this is the course I taught Spring on Web Technologies, this is Nancy McCracken's web class, and so on. And if you click on that, you will find listed here, and this is not always guaranteed to be accurate, all foil sets for this class, which I, if I've entered them properly, should be here. And if you click here on the search, you should search, it should find everything. This should search all those foil sets. So there's a search button, if you like, for the class. Which I should probably put on the class home page as well. Where PDE is mentioned. Alright, so that's some sort of discussion of some capabilities that have only been hinted at up to now. We're going to... actually, we were in the middle of the file tab which described iterative methods and how they're used to solve partial differential equations in the spirit of maximizing confusion. We will now discuss this particular. We'll go to a slightly different foil set, one which I actually tried to discuss the previous two lectures, but was unable to discuss because the web version was incorrect, which is a more general discussion of partial differential equations. I believe you have the printout of these foil sets. So you should have got two foil sets given to you, one of which was this one, the other one is the one we're in the middle of. Not meant to do that. All right. So I can actually now use this as an excuse to discuss this system. So this is Web Wisdom, which is, as you see, what I use to deliver the foils. And so this is exactly the same material that we had through. I just described, but it's presented in a different fashion. It's presented in frames so that you have the foils here, the index of the foils here, and a bunch of buttons up the top which do various things of value. Feeling the web server is about to die. It's certainly extremely slow. This one you may, if you want to, you can log into. And the reason I do that is so I can access my favorite files. And the purpose of this file is to scale the foils so that they fit this screen. You will notice the foils displayed this way are larger than they are on the other foil sets. And that's because they use the Netscape capability to reset the size of foils. So finally, at the end of this brilliant description, we're back at this foil which caused us to go off the wall. All right, so here we are. So we're about to start. So there are, since I'm trying to give you some intuition as to what types of problems give you what types of algorithms, and in the following foils I will actually describe these very briefly, these types of problems. So I claim that if you look at the descriptions of matter, then there are there are sort of four natural descriptions of matter which tend to give different algorithms and different numerical methods, and they can be used in a bunch of fields. So I mean, though I say quantum physics, that can actually be such a quantum description can be applied in chemistry as well. And the only reason I use physics is not just because I have a physics PhD, because in some sense physics is the fundamental description of whatever these other fields are. So the only comment, the only other type of description that's actually quite important, which is not described here, is what I think I may have mentioned before when I discussed event-driven simulations. These four things here are the fundamental descriptions of matter. When you want to describe the fundamental equations, actually most computing is done with these so-called event-driven simulations, where you represent a process as a bunch of macroscopic objects, like, as it mentions here, a chemical plant as a bunch of linked processes, and those give you very different types of algorithms. The four types there are the four fundamental descriptions. Okay. And if you were a pure physicist, you might distinguish general relativity as a yet different description, because these ones here are at least assuming that the world is three-dimensional and things evolve in time, whereas in general relativity the world is four-dimensional and time and space are intrinsically mixed. Alright. So, if you were a... I guess at some level, this is the most fundamental description. Quantum physics is the most fundamental description of the world, because it describes the protons and electrons traveling around protons to form atoms. And would, in principle, so you could actually use quantum physics to describe any process. So when you air flows over an airplane wing, in principle, you could use a quantum description of the molecules in the air, and you would link them all together and solve the so-called many-body problem. The reason you don't do that is a trivial one. But that would be unnecessary, because the properties of air flowing on a wing are insensitive to the detailed quantum physics of the problem, and B is computationally impossible. You cannot possibly solve the computational fluid dynamics at that level of with such a description. It just would take too long. So whenever you look at a problem, you have to describe. You have to choose a sort of suitable approximation level. And that's, of course, where the application scientists would come in. And so if you are looking at the fundamental particles, you would certainly use quantum physics. the quantum description, if you're doing a certain fundamental chemistry computation, such as finding the potentials between molecules from first principles, you would also use quantum physics, because those potentials reflect the quantum structure of the system. So, so if you look at quantum physics, they tend to give two types of problems. Well, actually, maybe three types of problems here I've listed here. The first is the solution of so-called Schrödinger's equation, which is a partial differential equation. And so that would be subject to the same types of methods we were starting to discuss. Schrödinger's equation is a wave equation, and it has a lot of it has complex properties, which, if you like, are sort of a complication of what you get from what we discussed for the simple wave equations earlier. If you read the literature, you will find a lot of quantum problems are formulated as large matrix problems. If you have a set of chemical reactions where a bunch of chemical species are transforming into another bunch of chemical species, that will be often defined by matrices, which are the transition probabilities or transition amplitudes. And so a set of quantum problems end up as large matrix diagonalization problems. And you will find that one of the largest uses of matrix algorithms is chemistry. So if you look at student Frank Lin, he's doing a thesis on which is connected with a chemistry package called MOPAC. MOPAC involves diagonalizing a matrix, because you need to find the so-called the eigenvectors of these matrices are the energy states of the system. And so you'll find a lot of use of matrix modification to form the matrices, matrix eigenvalues to find the actual stable states or the fundamental states will come in quantum problems. However, the dominant quantum physics problem is one I described under numerical integration, which is typified by something called quantum thermodynamics, which is effectively use the so-called path integral formulation, and you get this large statistical problem where you just do Monte Carlo methods. So that's sort of the dominant approach to quantum physics. So if you have a bunch of particles, like molecules in a chemical compound, you can study. So if you want to know whether a particular molecule is going to be a nifty drug which will capture this virus and wrap it up and stop it from doing what these bad things, it turns out, although you do not need to use quantum physics to describe that, because the critical features of that problem occur at distances between atoms which are so large that the quantum effects are small. So there's a class of chemistry problems which are done as particle dynamics, probably the most, especially the chemistry or biochemistry. So biochemistry is roughly chemistry of compounds which are of interest in biology, such as proteins. And you will find that probably the most interesting problems in those areas are molecular dynamics problems or particle dynamics problems, which are what we discussed in that set of we discussed the interacting particles. We sort of implied we were talking about Newton's laws of the gravitating particles. But if you have the more complex law of interactions between chemical particles, that's what you need to describe the dynamics of proteins. The interesting feature of the dynamics of proteins is that they're essentially limited in practice to less than or equal to about 100,000 atoms, whereas the corresponding astrophysics problems are more typified by many millions of particles. So each sort of field of science has different structure. The chemistry problems are more complicated because the interactions within the particles are very complex, because chemical compounds have a lot of structure, whereas whereas galaxies just have Newton's laws for their interaction between them. They have a very simple force law, whereas chemistry problems have a very complex force law, and they have very complex geometries. So I'm going to try to summarize at the end of this course a bunch of sort of interesting algorithms, and I've already mentioned this fast multiple algorithm, which we'll discuss then, which happens to be applicable for the very large number of particles you see in astrophysics. So astrophysics is particle dynamics, because certainly galaxies are a lot farther apart than 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. 10 to the minus 13 centimeters is a typical distance when quantum effects are important. And so, so chemistry is at 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, and so there's some effect of quantum theory, but not much. And astrophysics is at hundreds of light years, and so there's absolutely no interest in looking at quantum effects. And so you only see the classical dynamics of gravitating particles. But it's numerically, the algorithms in some sense are the same between astrophysics and chemistry. So statistical physics is another important approach which can be used in physics or chemistry. So I mentioned that a typical chemical molecule might be 100,000 particles, but that's not a very interesting number of particles for if you're studying the property of matter, because there is meant to be they're of order 10 to the 23 atoms in a sort of typical molecular volume. So any interesting sort of block of matter has some huge number of particles, and they're interacting with each other in a very complex fashion. And so the theory of statistical physics says that although you could use Newton's laws to track all those particles, actually what properties you see have nothing to do with Newton's laws. They have something to do with Newton's laws, but you can study them on the average using statistical physics or the laws of thermodynamics. And there's a thing called the partition function, which is the relative probability of each state, and then all the properties of a large system can be calculated by doing Monte Carlo integrals weighted by this partition function. So here we're essentially using the central limit theorem, that when you have anything interesting going on and there are a lot of things involved and everything's happening essentially randomly, then you can just take averages and use the central limit theorem. And so for a large class of problems, you can use statistical methods to find out what's going on. So material science would typically use statistical physics to find out what's happening. So that ends up as large Monte Carlo problems, where you're studying the properties of a bunch of atoms. All right, so finally we come to continuum physics. And so the idea of continuum physics is so when we're studying airflow over, or we're studying, I know, the flow of blood in an artery or airflow over a wing, what's really going on is a bunch of particles are flowing. Because that's what air and blood are made of. But rather than describe such a system by particles, we describe them in the so-called continuum approximation as a density, essentially a density of particles, whether they be proteins or hydrogen and oxygen molecules. And so you discuss the properties of little volumes of whatever fluid it be, whether it be air or blood or treacle. And the point is that in most problems of that type, because there are typically, you know, a typical number of particles in any volume of interest is of order 10 to the 23, which is essentially Avogadro's number, there are so many particles that I can divide them into little small volumes so that all properties of that, all the properties of the particle in that volume are essentially the same. So if I have air flowing, the velocity of all those particles, or the average velocity, is the same, and I do not need to discuss the particular particles, but just effectively use statistical physics to average over that little volume. So the idea of continuum physics is that for most problems of interest, there is a limit where we can take little blocks of volume such that properties of the particles in that there are enough particles to use averaging, and that we can choose a small volume, even when we choose a small enough volume, so that the things like velocity are constant. So there's some interesting cases when it breaks down, namely when the shuttle re-enters the atmosphere. So most of the time, you can calculate what happens to that shuttle, how it heats up and stuff, using computational fluid dynamics with partial differential equations. However, you will find at the tip of the shuttle, the air gets so rarefied and there's so few particles involved that you actually have to use particle dynamics. And so there's a thing called, direct simulation Monte Carlo, which is effectively uses Monte Carlo when for a part of the problem and uses continuum approach for the other part of the problem. So there you get a sort of interesting mix algorithm where for the continuum physics we'll have partial differential equations, and for a small part of the problem we'll have to use Monte Carlo. But again, of course, the only people who can tell you that are the application scientists. They're the ones who know enough about the problem to know that the densities are so small that the approximations break down. All right, so what I wanted to discuss now is computational fluid dynamics. And the most important lesson that we want to get out of these few foils, which because we won't do all of them, is what is the difference between computational fluid dynamics, which is some real theory, which is possibly the dominant user of partial differential equations, what is the difference between that and Laplace's equation, which is the equation used in all computer science papers, which think they're developing some wonderful new technology for solving PDEs. Because there are some important differences between these real equations and the sort of generic equation, which lead to important practical differences. So, most so the computational fluid dynamics can cover a broad range of problems. The most common problem is where the fluid is actually a gas, then it's air. I mean, air is not normally thought of as a fluid, but the dominant application of computational fluid dynamics is to a particular fluid called air, and to a particular thing traveling through that air called an aircraft. I just came back from a meeting at NASA Langley, where NASA Langley is the NASA's lead lab in the area of aeronautics, and we had a very interesting. I always thought there's a very talented computational fluid dynamicist from Boeing, Paul Rupert, who comes to such meetings. And he always describes to us the practical nitty-gritty details of what Boeing has to do when they design an aircraft. So one interesting point he made was that computational fluid dynamics is actually more reliable than wind tunnels these days. When you're testing an aircraft, you have two choices. You can make a model, stick it in a wind tunnel, blow wind over it or air, and see what happens. Or you can make a model on the computer way, and then see what the model gives. Now, both of them are actually inaccurate, because the CFD, to be practical, has to be an approximation. And the wind tunnel, you do not put a 747 in a wind tunnel, you put a model of the 747 in the wind tunnel. And you have you have finite size wind tunnels and all sorts of things. So actually, it turns out although there are approximations in the numerical computation, there are at least as many approximations in the wind tunnel. On the other hand, it turns out that wind tunnels, once you get them set up, they're easier to take data, because you can just, when you want to run for if you want to study the motion of how your 747 takes off and lands in different weather conditions, you're going to have all sorts of different parameters. It's much easier to change those parameters in a wind tunnel and read off the results than to keep rerunning the program. So it turns out that most of the simulations they do are in wind tunnels, but the first simulations are the most accurate ones that are actually numerical. Superficially, you can say that decisions made by Boeing on the design of aircraft and the ones you will be flying in the future are actually all made using numerical simulations. The last details of the design are made using wind tunnels. So it turns out that he estimated that for the 777, which was the last big plane Boeing designed, which is just coming into service, they made some 2 million simulations to study that design, most of which were wind tunnel simulations. And actually, the interesting thing about CFD is another amusing feature is mainly a marketing tool. The way they designed the 777, they had 8 airlines sitting at Boeing telling them what they wanted. They said, the customers want this level of noise, this size aircraft, and they kept on designing aircraft to meet the airline's needs. And they used CFD to model the performance of that aircraft. So CFD was used in interacting with the airlines, because Boeing builds aircraft essentially which the airlines need. They don't sit in an office and say, well, let's build this. They sit and talk to the airlines and say, all right, how about this and this and this and this? And they did that for a couple of years, and they finally came up with a 777, and the airline said, well, buy it. And then as soon as they said that, then they started building the wind tunnel models, did the detailed studies, but the decision about what to build was actually made using computational flow dynamics. If you want to enter marketing in the aerospace industry, you should study CFD. So we're going to study this, study CFD in more detail. All right. So the most important feature of CFD, which we could actually maybe we don't really need to go into a great deal of detail, is number of variables and roughly the structure of the equations. So the first four variables, which are relatively the first key difference between CFD and Laplace's equation and this is a difference we've hinted at already in the class, is that each grid point, we're going to use finite difference or something we haven't quite discussed yet, finite elements. And the key difference between the model equations we solved and CFD is that CFD will turn out to have five variables defined at each grid point. One of them is going to be energy, which we'll come to later. The first four are very simple. They are density, the fluid density, obviously that intuitively is an interesting variable, and the other one is the fluid velocity, and as the fluid is running around in three dimensions, the fluid velocity is three variables. So at every point on your on your grid, you're going to turn out, if you do proper CFD, you'll have maybe full CFD, you'll have five unknowns to be solved for, not one. And it will turn out that if you look at the property, that will have a lot of impact on things like performance, because you will find that because there are more components there, the amount of computation is actually grows more than linearly in the number of components. It tends to grow quadratically in the number of components, whereas the amount of communication grows linearly in the number of components. So the typical compute communication ratios are much better for CFD than they are for Laplace's equation. So that's an interesting property of real problems. The complexity of real problems actually makes their parallel performance better. It makes them run slower, but that slowness corresponds to more computing, and the computing goes up more than the communication. So it's reasonably important to understand that. So we don't need to discuss these equations in detail. The first four equations are relatively straightforward. The first equation, the so-called continuity equation, basically says that describes the time dependence of the density, and it says that if I'm sitting at if I look at the time dependence of a density at any one point, it changes for two reasons: one, because the density itself changes, and the other, because the fluid volume actually moves, because the particles are moving, and so they'll move to a different region of space where the density is different. So we do not need to study that analysis in detail. If you happen to read any books on partial differential equations or continuum physics, you will find sometimes they discuss two types of time derivatives. One is a time derivative of a fixed position, which is usually denoted little delta d by dt, and the other is a time derivative on a particle. So, and they actually, you will find that there are often two formulations of differential equations, because when you have things moving, you can either take, you can either sit and move with the particles, or you can sit still at a fixed point in space. They're two natural coordinate systems. And sometimes equations are best done in a moving frame, and sometimes they're best done in the fixed frame, the fixed space-time frame, which is sort of absolute, or you just sit and move with the particles, which means your frame effectively moves with respect to absolute space-time. And so that you will find sometimes this notation big B by dt, which means the time derivative moving with the particle. But, and there's a straightforward equation that denotes little d by dt to big d by dt. Well, so the most important equations are effectively Newton's laws, namely when we did particle dynamics, we had an equation for the time dependence of the velocity, which is the acceleration, which is the force on the particles. So we have to use the fact that we got these continuum equations by averaging over all the particles in them and use Newton's laws on those particles, could convert it to Newton's laws in a volume. And that will end up involving some properties of the fluid, which will involve something called the stress tensor if you're an engineer. It turns out the force on the particles has two terms, a pressure, which is the normal force pressing the volume in, and a stress, which is the force tangential to the surface. And the most interesting part of computational fluid dynamics is not the pressure, but the stress tangential to the surface. And there's a thing called viscosity, which enters when you do the stress tangential to the surface. So you end up, after a diligent study of continuum physics, that the equation for the acceleration, which is the time dependence of the velocity, which happens to be expressed in terms of these moving coordinates here, there's some absolute force, which could be gravity, if these particles had significant mass. There's a pressure term, and then there's another term, which in the simplest cases, just is proportional to the Laplacian operator acting on the velocity, which is multiplied by viscosity. So the viscosity will turn out to be very important. Fifth equation is effectively the energy equation, which effectively can be often ends up with the equation of state, which relates the pressure to the temperature. So the critical feature that you deduce about these equations, which are different from what you had before, is that there are five variables at each grid point, and something which has a lot of implications for the solutions, but not particularly for the computer science, that they're non-linear in these independent variables. Whereas the classic Laplace's equation is a linear equation. And if you take one solution with a given boundary values and another solution with different boundary values, and if you add the things together, you'll get a solution with the added boundary values. That's not true in CFT because things are non-linear. So we want to discuss why CFD is difficult. why it's much harder than Laplace's equation. So we can certainly, we will effectively discretize this problem by generating one of our standard meshes, and we would expect when you're doing an aircraft problem, an aircraft as solved by Boeing, I think it would have at most a million points. So there would be typically 100, so which you would get, which is sort of intuitively reasonable. A three-dimensional problem, you might expect it to be 100 by 100 by 100. However, we see these points have to be carefully chosen. So the trivial level was just classic discretization we saw for Laplace's equation. However, if you look at a grid, so here's a typical grid used to define an aircraft. And you will see that the grid is highly non-uniform. And so that has a lot of computer science challenges. So there's a lot of work on on the computer science tools to support CFD, which comes because the grid is bound to be non-uniform in a rather dramatic fashion. And we'll see why that is quite soon. As you see from this picture, the grid has the property that is much finer near the aircraft than it is far from the aircraft. So that's not actually terribly intuitively unreasonable. If you think about airflow around an aircraft, what this says is that the critical parameters, velocity and density, are varying much more rapidly near the aircraft than they are far away. And so if we want to set up a grid, we need most of our points. We'd like to have roughly constant percentage change in each cell. That's going to happen most plausibly if we set up a grid that's got more points near the aircraft than far away. All right, so before we discuss that, here's actually relatively old foils, and I won't go through all of these. So what this is meant tell you is the rough sizes of problems. So here we have 5 million grid points. We're going to solve it by one of these iterative methods we're starting to discuss, a more sophisticated version of what we're going to do. A critical feature which will become clear, which I've already mentioned, is that the number of operations per grid point are much higher than the Laplace's equation. The Laplace's equation is three dimensions. There may be, depending on it, maybe about 7 floating point operations per, so I do an update because you have six neighboring points and you multiply by a number. So there's around 6 or 7 actual floating point operations per grid point update. For computational fluid dynamics, there are far more floating point operations per grid point. And so this, in those days, was, so this is sort of NASA's estimate of what you need, which estimated that you would need somewhere between gigaflop performance, which you can now get on a high-end workstation, and I guess teraflop performance. So I will not discuss the more detailed figures there. partly because they're not so obviously the details are probably not terribly accurate. I want to just return and look at the equations in a little more detail. So the most interesting equations are Newton's laws. And the reason why they're the most interesting equations is that those are the ones with the highest order derivatives. The continuity equation and the energy equation only have first order derivatives in them. Newton's laws have second order derivatives in it. The term involving viscosity is a second order derivative, del squared, d by the x squared plus d by the y squared plus d by the z squared. So let's sort of look at that in a little more detail. As I mentioned here, it is also nonlinear because we have rho, which is an independent variable, times velocity multiplied into velocity. So these are actually end up being cubic in the independent variables. All right. So if you transform variables by making everything dimensionless in terms of a typical velocity, a typical density, and a typical length, and rewrite the equation in terms of scaled variables, you will find that you get a coefficient which has no dimensions, and it's independent of the units in which you use to express things, which multiplies the number del squared v. It multiplies the term del squared v. And when you read discussions of computational fluid dynamics, they will always talk about the Reynolds number. And the Reynolds number is essentially the inverse of viscosity in dimensionless units. So it's the typical density times the typical velocity times the typical length divided by the viscosity. And so now if you look up your viscosity, I mean if you have any intuition as to the meaning of viscosity, we know that the high viscosity means that whatever thing you have has a high resistance to movement in it. So if you have treacle, I mean if aircraft flew in treacle, they would have a lot of viscosity, there would be a lot of resistance to the movement of that aircraft. Now aircraft fly in air, which have very small resistance to movement, so which is force. Remember the viscosity came in as the force term. When you have air flowing over a wing, the viscosity is the term which effectively is the force on the air. It's the tangential force. And so we know intuitively that air has a very low viscosity and treacle has a very high viscosity, well, a comparatively high viscosity. So the most important feature of CFD is that the most interesting application, which is where the fluid is air, corresponds to the case where the viscosity is very low. And so now viscosity has units, so it will depend on whether you measure things in miles or centimeters or what have you. So we use Reynolds number, which has no units. So aircraft have Reynolds numbers which are measured in the millions. 10 million or 100 million. Very, very large. So this Reynolds number is, say, 10 to the 7th to 10 to the 8th for a real aircraft. And it will turn out that if aircraft flew in treacle, they may not fly very well, but it would be very easy to calculate that they didn't fly very well. The fact that they fly in air means they fly well, but they're very hard to calculate. people. So we can't read this for us, so we'll skip this one. So let me just describe why, intuitively, why a large Reynolds number or a small viscosity produces a peculiar feature. Alright, so say there's this counterintuitive feature that air is harder than treacle, because you might have thought treacle was harder to do than air, but it's not true. Air is the hardest. And the reason is the following. If you look at the differential equation, we get viscosity, or 1 over r, times the highest derivative, del squared. So, if you have some air, so this air sitting here in the middle of the room, in fact, any air in this room, the viscosity is irrelevant, because it's tiny, things aren't changing very much, so mu del squared V is negligible. So this air is happily doing its thing, churning through, coming out into the room, and you can ignore its viscosity, because the velocities aren't changing very fast, and del squared V is not especially big. Therefore, mu del squared V, or del squared V over R, is a tiny quantity. So for normal air, which is where nothing much is happening, you can ignore the second derivative term. And so you'll find, if you look at books on CFD, a large discussion of the times when you could ignore the second derivative. And so there's something called laminar flow, which is effectively what you get when you can ignore the viscosity, and if you're doing your aircraft or your car or what have you, that's what happens a long way away from the aircraft. So those are actually described by very simple, relatively simple equations. There's a set of equations which we won't go into called Euler's equations, which you get when you make neglect viscosity and also make a few other assumptions. And that describes excellently what happens far away from an aircraft. Now, when you're near an aircraft, then get so-called turbulent flow and vortices and stuff like that, and you will find, and those correspond to the fact that the viscosity is extremely important near an aircraft. So let's understand why viscosity is important near an aircraft. So the reason is very simple. Here is our wing. Well, it's not a very good wing, but that's meant to be a wing. So this wing is traveling through the air at whatever it is, 550 miles per hour. And that air is sort of, if we ignore the wind, is stationary. So it's 0 miles per hour. If you look at a fluid particle next to the wing, that fluid particle, it gets stuck to the wing. Because of the viscosity, its viscous, it rigorously has have the same velocity as the wing at the wing or at the aircraft. So you have this, you must have, so when you have this. Alright, so when viscosity is non-zero, as soon as you switch on viscosity, the air gets stuck. So if you have no viscosity, you happen to have a fluid with no viscosity, what would happen is the air would not stick to the wing, it would travel at 0 miles per hour roughly, The aircraft would go at 550 miles an hour and it would be very easy to stop. As soon as I switch on viscosity, intuitively nothing much happens far away, but just next to the wing, the air gets stuck to the wing and it actually must travel at zero velocity with respect to the wing. So mathematically, the equation goes from first to second order next to the wing because the viscosity only multiplies that second order term. So what you end up getting is let me just finish by describing this one foil here. So what you always get when you solve CFD for aircraft is a so-called boundary layer. And roughly, this is not quite true, but roughly the boundary layer is the region where viscosity is important, and it's the region where here we have a long way away from the wing, we have laminar flow, here's the wing where we have zero velocity. So essentially there's got to be a region where the velocity goes from, if we're moving with the aircraft, from zero to minus 550 miles per hour. And in that region, the viscosity is extremely important. We have to have extremely fast, we have very fast changes because we know that just dimensionally, that the derivatives must go like 1 over the viscosity, because the term is viscosity times derivative. To make that number at all interesting, it must that product must be of order unity. So what you end up is a so-called boundary layer, where on general grounds the boundary layer goes like the square root of the Reynolds number. So we have attached to each wing, you have this boundary layer, which is essentially the layer where the viscosity is important, the velocity changes by 550 miles per hour in the case of this aircraft, and we go from a second order equation in the boundary layer to a first order equation far from the boundary layer. So now, of course, so then we get something called turbulence, and what happens with turbulence is this boundary layer separates from the wing, or the so-called vorticity, or this complicated, rapidly varying velocity, little fluid volumes detach from the wing, and they go out into the laminar flow, and so you get this feature of, when you have smooth flow, you just have a boundary layer, you have laminar flow far away, and the two don't talk to each other, and you have a relatively simple problem. But in a turbulent flow, you get this separation of the boundary layer and turbulence moving into the fluid, and that translates into an uncomfortable ride using more fuel because the drag goes up, because you get a lot more resistance to movement because of this effect. And so the CFD so if we summarize what this means for CFD, it means that CFD has to be incredibly careful about geometry. So the geometry is critical in these problems, because we have the actual shape of the aircraft is critical. In interesting regions, we have these so-called separations and turbulence developing, which means that we get rapidly varying fluid volumes going out into general parts of the fluid in a way that we can't predict. So-called shocks developing, which are effectively, again, regions where things vary very rapidly. And these are very critical to calculate, because these actually translate into increased costs of running an aircraft, because you'll have more fuel, because you'll have more drag, more force on the aircraft as it travels through the air. So we have complex geometry, which is bad, because that makes life harder. The thing that makes life better is that we have lots of variables, which means that we tend to get better communication over computation. So these foils have somewhat more detail, but for the purpose of this class, this is probably enough to summarize the issues. and it points out that, you know, something like the simple Laplace's equation misses a lot of essential features. If you just did Laplace's equation, you do not realize you have to have changing complex grids, and you do not realize that you have multiple points, entries described at each grid point. I guess I should also mention CFD, we have five entities per grid point. If we do something like a complex atmospheric computation where we're keeping track of a lot of chemicals in the atmosphere, then you can go up to something like 150 different constituents, and you then, so you have 150 points described at each entities described at each grid point. Then you have an even better communication over computation ratio. So all these different sciences have very important features that impact, which make the sort of naive computer science analysis you get from looking at Laplace's equation totally misleading. Before we